This is Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to an interview with actor Martin Landau. He died Saturday at the age of 89. For 20 years, Landau took many movie and TV roles that he didn't much like. When he finally got a challenging role as a businessman hustler in Francis Ford Coppola's 1988 film Tucker, Landau was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. The next year, Woody Allen gave him a part in Crimes and Misdemeanors as a philandering husband who has his mistress murdered when she threatens to tell his wife about their affair. Again, Landau was nominated for an Oscar. He won an Oscar for his 1994 portrayal of Bela Lugosi in Tim Burton's movie Ed Wood. More recently, he received 2 Emmy nominations for his performance in the TV series Without a Trace. Back in the 60s, Landau was best known for his role in the TV series Mission Impossible as covert operations agent Rollin Hand. Landau got his start in the Actors Studio, which was founded in the late 40s in New York by Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg, and was the training ground for actors such as Marlon Brando, James Dean, Geraldine Page, Robert De Niro, and Steve McQueen. When I spoke with Landau in 1990, he told me about getting admitted to the Actors Studio in 1955.
That year, 2,000 people auditioned trying to get in, and 2 were accepted that year. Steve McQueen and I were the only 2. And it was tough to get in. It's still tough to get in.
What did you have to do to get in?
Well, I did a scene, a 5-minute scene with a partner, not classical, contemporary, a give-and-take scene. You can't do a monologue, and it's still the case. And I did a scene from a play called Clash by Night. Lee Strasberg actually directed it on Broadway with a cast consisting of Lee J. Cobb, Tallulah Bankhead, and Joseph Schildkraut. At any rate, I chose a 5-minute scene from that piece. Everyone told me I was crazy because Lee had directed it, and they said there would be no way that he would agree with what I chose because of his closeness to that material. At any rate, the final audition was being judged by Ilya Kazan, who directed Streetcar Named Desire and on Broadway and in the movie and on the waterfront and East of Eden, and Cheryl Crawford, who was a famous Broadway producer and one of the co-founders of the Group Theater, and Lee Strasberg. And you had to get 3 one votes from all of them. 1, 2, or 3. 3 meant no, 2 meant not bad, come back another time, and 1 meant you were in. And I guess in retrospect, it was a bit daring. But Strasberg gave me a 1 vote as well.
So it was you and Steve McQueen who got in of those 2,000 people who auditioned. Were you and Steve McQueen competitive with each other at all as the 2 newcomers?
Not really, no. Steve was very different physically than I was. I was very lean and very dark and much more ethnic and feel. And Steve was, I think he was much more competitive with a very close friend of mine called Jimmy Dean, James Dean. I was in a different sort of category. Johnny Cassavetes and Sidney Pollack and those kinds of fellows were my competition.
Mm-hmm. Now, you stuck with the Actors Studio as a teacher. You met a lot of actors before they had the screen personas that they're now famous for. For instance, Jack Nicholson, who had been one of your students. Would you have guessed, working with him early on, that he would have become, I don't mean as famous as he is, but that he would have had the kind of persona that we now know him for?
Yes, a lot of that was evident. I mean, it's silly to say that, but it's true. In choosing that particular group of people, there were 16 in all, I saw 200 people, and I spent my time not auditioning them, but talking to them and trying to discourage them from coming into my class, because what I did in the class demanded a certain kind of allegiance and diligence and tenacity and hard work. But I looked for things in the people, and Jack did all the right things wrong and all the wrong things right, which was what I always looked for. Strange. It's hard to say. It's sort of a kinesthetic thing. But I saw a lot of stuff in Jack. And he looked like the boy next door in those days, but there was nothing about the boy next door in his persona.
Knowing as many actors and directors as you did through the Actors Studio, how do you think that affected your early career, getting roles?
Well, I was always considered very offbeat in those days. I was
for
very,
what reasons?
Very thin.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was very thin,
mm-hmm.
Exceedingly thin. If you look at North by Northwest, you'll get a clue. And
you were one of the spies in North by Northwest.
Well, James Mason and I played the 2 spies. Very, very lean and very kind of stark looking. And it was a period where plays like Picnic were being done on Broadway and movie actors looked more like Rock Hudson and Guy Madison and Tab Hunter, and I was, you know, intrinsically a character actor, but not easy to cast because of a very, you know, it was a different time. I mean, there were no, you know, Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman and Bobby De Niro would also have had a great deal of problem in those days because they would have been considered offbeat, but times change. And I wound up playing many, many bad guys in movies as a result of my looks.
Like what? Which kind of roles are you talking about? Which movies?
Well, all kinds, you know. I mean, gangsters and the Untouchables. I would always be some kind of deadly guy, you know, who talk like this, you know, very dangerous. And just, you know, westerns. I mean, if you look at a picture like Nevada Smith, I play a demoniacal killer. That Steve McQueen chases down because my character, along with Arthur Kennedy and Carl Malden, have killed his parents. That's the essence of that film that Henry Hathaway directed. As you know, Hitchcock cast me in North by Northwest, even though he saw me in a play in which I didn't play a conventional bad guy, though I was the catalyst in the piece. It was Paddy Chayefsky's first play on Broadway called Middle of the Night. I toured with that, and that brought me to California, and Hitchcock saw me on opening night and had me in mind for North by Northwest as a result of that, though the character was 180 degrees different than the role I played in North by Northwest. So the old guys, I mean, the old, wonderful, imaginative fellows historically have always had imagination and broken conventional thinking. I mean, even as recently as my being cast in Tucker, I mean, I don't think there's anyone in the world who would have cast me in Tucker other than Fred Roos, who was Francis Coppola's producer, and Francis Coppola. It would not have been conventional thinking on anyone's part, for, you know. In fact, there were people who, after they'd heard I'd been cast in that role, who were involved, were surprised at the casting. But
what would have surprised them about it? I mean, you fit the role so perfectly, seeing the movie.
Well, that's after the fact.
Right, that's after the fact. How was the role?
I mean,
role...
everyone is very quick to jump on that right. After the fact in this world. And on the, you know, and I mean, immediately after playing Tucker, there were you know, script after script after script with a lot of very ethnic, mostly Jewish, older men were sent my way. It takes a Woody Allen to think of me as the character I played in Crimes and Misdemeanors. Again, a departure from anything I'd ever done before and anything he'd seen me in before. But it takes those, you know, I'm an actor who's got a very wide range. I mean, much more so than almost anyone I know, in deference to myself. I'm not speaking, you know, egocentrically at all, but I do have a very wide range. I could play a lot of things. And it's hard for people, and logically hard, and understandably hard for people to think of me for certain roles.
Actor Martin Landau is my guest. You have received Academy Award nominations both for Tucker and for your role in Woody Allen's movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yes.
Now, you had told us that it was like 20 years since you'd gotten like a really good movie role.
That's right.
How did you feel to like in the mind of the public, you know, and some people in Hollywood, to kind of go overnight from being the guy who played the heavy all the time in movies to suddenly being this, you know, venerated actor, you know?
Well, it's you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, among actors over the years, I've always had a great deal of respect from them as a director, as an actor,
as a teacher.
So, I mean, it's something that they've always said to me, what's wrong with the business? I mean, I know a number of actors, for instance, personally, who should be doing much more work than they are doing because they're awfully good. But I work with a lot of the great directors when I first came to Hollywood with a reputation as a good New York actor, theater actor, live television actor. So that seemed to have been curtailed by my quote-unquote success on Mission Impossible, where suddenly I became super spy and, you know...
So you feel in a way that Mission Impossible hurt your career?
Well, it helped
afterwards.
Me in many ways, mm-hmm. and it hurt me in other ways.
Yeah.
But I think there are always, when somebody gives you something for a headache, there are sometimes side effects. You get an upset stomach.
Right.
I got a chance to play almost a one-man rep company, everything from Adolf Hitler to Martin Bormann, to myself, blonde and young, 10 years younger, to all kinds of different dialects and accents and the like, you know.
and the Middle European people and crazy, all kinds of things, if you know what I'm saying, my dear.
You were the master of disguises on the show.
That's right, a man of a thousand faces.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1990 interview with Martin Landau. He died Saturday at the age of 89. One of his best-known performances is in the Woody Allen film Crimes and Misdemeanors. He played Judah Rosenthal, a philandering husband whose mistress is threatening to tell his wife about their affair. She's also threatening to reveal information about Judah's questionable business deals. In this scene, Judah's brother, played by Jerry Orbach, tells Judah that he has friends who can take care of Judah's problems. Martin Landau, as Judah, speaks first.
I'm fighting for my life. This woman's going to destroy everything I've built.
That's what I'm saying, Judah. If the woman won't listen to reason, then you go on to the next step.
What, threats? Violence? What are we talking about here?
She can be gotten rid of. I mean, I know a lot of people. Money will buy whatever's necessary.
I'm not even going to comment on that. That's mind-boggling.
Well, what did you want me to do when you called me?
Not to do dirty work, despite what you think. I don't know what I expected from you, Jack, but...
You know, you're not aware of what goes on in this world. I mean, you sit up here with your 4 acres...
Don't give me any
and your
of that
country
stuff.
Club,
I don't want to hear about my
and
success.
And your rich friends, and out there in the real world, it's a whole different story.
Come on.
I've met a lot of characters from when I had the restaurant.
I know you have. I've heard these stories before.
From 7th Avenue, from Atlantic City. And I'm not so high class that I can avoid looking at realities. I can't afford to be aloof. When you come to me with a hell of a problem, and then you get high-handed on me.
Jack, I don't mean to be high-handed. I haven't been sleeping nights. I'm irritable, okay?
Okay. Okay, forget I said anything.
Let me just get something straight here. Am I understanding you right? I mean, are you suggesting getting rid of her?
You won't be involved. But I'll need some cash.
What will they do?
What'll they do? They'll handle it.
I can't believe I'm talking about a human being, Jack. She's not an insect. You don't just step on her.
Let me ask you about Crimes and Misdemeanors. Did Woody Allen or one of his people call you and say, we want you for the role, or did you have to audition for it?
No, what happened was I got a call saying that Woody was interested in me for a role. And I said, well, is there a script? And then, which was greeted with laughter on the other side of the telephone because, I mean, Woody doesn't, you know. I mean, most of the time the actors don't read the whole script. No one reads the whole script except Woody and maybe Mia and the casting director. So, but I was then told that it would be worth my while to fly into New York, so I did. But prior to it, I also went out and did a little homework because I, reading a script and seeing a movie are two different experiences. So I went out to Samuel French, which is a theatrical bookstore here in Los Angeles and New York as well, and got eight of his screenplays. So when I met with Woody and we talked, he then gave me the script, which was unusual, I found out afterwards, to read in the hotel room, which I did. So it was the 9th screenplay of Woody's that I read in 4 days, and it was the best one. And it was one of those times when your heart starts beating faster and adrenaline starts flowing. First of all, it was the biggest male role he'd ever written outside of the Woody Allen character because his protagonists generally have been women. Diane Keaton, Mia Farrow, even recently Jenna Rollins, mm-hmm. Geraldine Page, and Interiors. So he'd never really written a big male character that wasn't played by Woody.
Why did he feel that you needed to read the whole script?
Because there was no way to play that character without knowing everything about that movie because of the delicacy of it. I mean, it's incredibly delicate thing. You're dealing with a man who's a rich brat of a man, who's a liar, who's a cheat, who's an embezzler, who's a murderer, who's I mean, it is not a redeeming thing he does, and yet the audience has to, you know, from my point of view, and this is what I expressed to Woody, has to empathize and sympathize and join up with him as they're being horrified by what he does. I felt it was essential that the audience see themselves in this character. And the only way to do that, I mean, the character doesn't do one single thing of redemption in the entire movie. He's an awful person. And I, you know, you could, in this clicker mentality we're living in, where people click things off television in 15 or 20 minutes, it would be very easy for the audience to say, hey, this guy's a jerk. I don't like him. And you don't have a movie. So how to delicately deal with that, and also, you know, the Claire Bloom character.
Who plays your wife.
Yes, but she doesn't know what it's a very delicate thing. I mean, she knows I'm having some problems, but she doesn't know the degree to which the problems are. I mean, there's a man who's having a major breakdown, a nervous breakdown, on top of the fact that he does something that is among the most heinous things a quote-unquote leading character has ever done.
So does Claire Bloom, when you were acting with Claire Bloom, had she not read the part of the script where it's revealed that you were a murderer?
Parts of the script.
So she had no idea what you were really guilty of. She knew something was up. She had no idea what when she was acting.
Well, she just knew that I was, you know, having some business problems, possibly.
Do you think this works? Do you think this is a good way to go about
doing it? Well, it depends. It works with Woody, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't want Angelica to know what kind of life my home life was, because I don't let her in on that. So Angelica's character was not privy to that part of the story. You know, a lot of times actors are bogged down by obligation. An actor knows much more about a character than the character knows about himself. And to know everything there is about a character consciously may not enable you to play the character necessarily. It's what motivates you unconsciously that drives you on. Characters reveal things inadvertently very often, not purposefully. No one walks into a crowded room at a cocktail party filled with strangers and says, "Hello, everybody, I'm embarrassed." You know, that's not something people do. Therefore, what people in that condition are trying to do is trying to convince themselves they're relaxed and trying to appear relaxed to other people, when in fact what's going on is contrary to that. So the actor has to create the degree of unrest and then try to cover it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My interview with Martin Landau was recorded in 1990. He died Saturday at the age of 89.